Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show. Today, I am joined by Nicola Saunders, who is a friend of mine, and I've known Nick for a little while, and she's a psychotherapist. Now, I'm just going to let Nick introduce herself, as she'll probably do it more justice than me.
Oh, thanks, Kate, for having me. I'm really excited to be here, actually. This is such an important subject. And yes, so I am a psychotherapist. I've been a therapist for over 20 years, but I'm also the founder and creator of the Empowered Parenting Program, which my passion is helping parents to explore their family cycles, their family patterns, whether they've come from good, bad, or indifferent backgrounds. It's really important for us to really understand why we become the parents that we do and why we become the people that we do. So that's where my passion lies. And I know that dovetails really nicely, really, in everything that you're doing as well, around trying to educate people about the importance of taking care of ourselves so that we can show up for our children in the best possible way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that sort of ties it, you know, leads me on to the theme, because I'm trying to keep a theme with monthly episodes. So this month I'm going to be focusing on the emotional and psychological impact, both in the short term and long term, domestic abuse has on children, and the exposure to it. And as I said, this sort of, you know, is what we're going to be talking about today, aren't we? Generational patterns is a huge, huge factor. Do you want to explain what generational patterns are?
Yeah, absolutely. So we all have generational patterns. We all have elements of our parents and our grandparents within us. Now, genetically, our personality is only 30% of our personality is genetic. Everything else is environmental. So 70% of our personality develops environmentally. But if we even think about the genetic element, you know, our eye colour and hair colour and our looks are passed down the generations. And what we're learning now is that actually our experiences are also a part of our genetic makeup. Now, that doesn't mean that our DNA changes as a result of trauma, but our genomes change as a result of trauma. So, for example, if our grandmother was traumatized, that can create a more anxious person. She might have been a more anxious person, and that anxiety, that level of adrenaline in her system can pass through to her eggs and therefore to our parents, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. So this is a part of science that we're really learning about now, and we have to acknowledge it. But in many ways, we have the opportunity as individuals to mitigate a lot of those traumatic patterns that are passed down the generations. But for many, many decades, we haven't, because one, we've not known about them. And secondly, we only know what we know. We grow up in our own environments and we see our own environments as normal. We think everybody else is going through exactly the same thing in childhood, and we don't see ourselves as going through it. It's just normal, right? And I've worked with many, many, many people over the years who, you know, when they're 30, 40, 50, 60, they'll look back to their childhoods, whether they were being physically, sexually, emotionally abused, would just go, well, at the time, I thought everybody was going through the same thing. And this is the thing we have to remember in childhood, is that children are very, very easily molded. in, and they don't see anything wrong in what's being done. However, we now have a generation of children that are super smart, and they are not just being educated by their parents and their families. They're
Well,
being
that's been
educated
there.
by, yeah, they're
That's been
being.
there. Children learn through mirroring. They learn through observation. And so if we do, we are not born knowing how to be calm and regulated. We have to be taught this. So if we've got parents that are naturally hypervigilant, that is what they are mirroring and learning from a very, very young age.
100%. And
Back to the womb, if
yeah.
the mother's in a hypervigilant state and in a state of anxiety or even experiencing depression when she's pregnant, or heaven forbid there are, which are a lot. I mean, obviously this is a show based on domestic abuse, but because it's very, very common for abuse and mothers to experience abuse during pregnancy. I know I did. So the baby can hear sounds inside the womb. So if there's a lot of shouting and screaming and crying and a lot of upset, and that's all the baby is hearing, those sound snapshots are being stored away as traumatic memories within the long-term memory as the brain's developing. So we've got a real big problem if a child is experiencing that from the womb. Their nervous system's primed for danger, and they've already got sound snapshots of shouting, crying, screaming, name calling. All these sounds are already being stored away in a long-term memory before they even entered the world. And then we wonder why children like that can't even be put down by their mom without getting incredibly distressed. And crying immediately. They only find regulation by being held by them a lot of the time. And I know that's something I found with my daughter. I couldn't leave her. I couldn't put her down. I remember the first time I put her into her, I moved her into her from her Moses basket into a big cot. The minute I left the room, she started screaming. She'd be asleep, and if I left the room, she'd wake up instantly. And she's been like that ever since. Ever
And
since.
the thing is, we're not just talking about snapshots of sounds. When a woman is in an environment where there is domestic abuse or shouting or whatever, if we think about it, it sets off her threat system. So her threat system releases adrenaline and cortisol. Now we have a baby's brain developing in our bodies. If a woman's body is flooded with adrenaline and cortisol, we're now not just talking about snapshots, we're talking about the baby's threat system being fired up because there's all of this adrenaline going on. So
So
this is massive stuff, and this is an area that is being, but there is more and more and more research about it. But we cannot deny that what is going on in pregnancy has an impact. But again, when that baby is then born, what their parents are modeling to them is so important. And we're not talking about developing a nice calm environment because it's a nice to have. We're talking about in the first 18 months of a baby's life, their brain is developing. And if they are at threat, in my program, I actually create this image of imagine a baby laying in a cot and they need something and they cry and nobody comes. And in the program, I talk about it in a way that the child has got or the baby has got a language. So the baby's laying there going, where is everybody? Where have they gone? Is there anybody there? If I cry a bit louder, maybe somebody will come. Oh my God, nobody's coming. I can't hear anybody. What's happening? Maybe I've been left alone. So, I know babies don't have a language at that point, but that's essentially what's going on in their brain. Their threat system is firing up, going, oh my God, I'm alone. And this is the thing is if a baby's brain is fired up in that way, their amygdala is fired up in that way regularly. That causes problems because that child is then more anxious. They are then starting to Need more soothing because they're trying to soothe that wound that we've spoken about before of I'm frightened that I am going to be abandoned here and I don't know what to do. So I think it's recognizing right from those very, very early days. And what we've got to remember, and something I think it's really hard being a parent is really, especially in those early days, you know, when you're exhausted and you've got no tolerance because you're not eating properly and you're recovering from potentially a very difficult birth. That's another thing. Birth is a tricky, I mean, having been through two myself, that is a whole another experience, and I'm sure more and more women are traumatized by their births than we actually
Yeah,
recognize.
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and then compound that with, I mean, I'll give you an example of mine. I mean, I my delivery was really traumatic. I was rushed in with preeclampsia. They tried to induce me. They couldn't get to my, was that's not just that much swelling. They couldn't even get to break my waters. So they ended up rushing me in for emergency C-section because I quote unquote I was going to drown in my own fluids. So that was very, very traumatic. Then to add insult to injury, the epidural didn't take, so it transpires that I am resistant to epidurals. So I felt everything through that whole procedure. I was screaming. I remember screaming in agony. I was clinging onto my ex's hand for dear life. Gas and air wasn't doing anything. And the nurse was saying, "Oh, you can feel it." Because I remember when they were doing spraying me with this like antifreeze freezing cold spray to check it, how effective. And they kept saying, "Can you feel that?" "Yeah, I can feel it." "Okay, but can you feel it more than that?" "No, I can't, but I can still feel it." And then when I was screaming out in pain, she was like, "Oh, you really can't feel it." "Yeah, well, yeah, I was trying to tell you this." So I had a really traumatic experience when my little girl was being born. And
And I
then
think,
compound that with it was straight away. I mean, I was on pins. I was on pins. I remember speaking, I was in intensive care. And I remember calling him as him and my mum left the hospital. And I knew he was drunk. I knew he was drunk. I knew he'd left that hospital and he'd gone and sneaked a drink straight away and necked it back so that my mum wouldn't know what he was doing. But I could hear it in his tone of voice that he'd had a drink. And I was on pins wondering how he was going to be with my mum. Because at that time, my mum was going through cancer treatment. So, obviously, I didn't want to expose her to that really. But yeah, so I was on pins the whole time. And then when I came out, obviously that continued. So all the conditions around me being pregnant, the delivery, and after birth was a horrific situation for my daughter. And then obviously that continued as she up until the age of five when I eventually got him out of our life. And so it's had a massive impact on her, massive impact. But
And I
it's
think
really important to consider all these things.
absolutely. And I think it's also really important to consider going back to the family patterns as to, well, why am I in this relationship? What makes this okay? What's happening here? So when somebody starts to, because it's never overtly obvious, or let's just say the first person that somebody is the first time somebody maybe gets aggressive or starts being violent, and then they're like, oh, I'm so sorry, that will never happen again. I'm really, really sorry. I promise that won't happen again. And it does. But at that point, that's when your self-esteem starts to drop. Now, the chances are that if you're in this relationship, it won't just be, there will have been lots of red flags. Loads of red flags before the violence begins.
But what we hope is, we hope it will, they will change, particularly when you're pregnant, the internal dialogue you as a victim have with yourself is that they'll change when the baby's born. We hope that that new life that they are responsible for, as much as you are, will change them. But it never does. And then we live on this hope that eventually they'll see sense, because we don't want to be single parents.
No.
The thought of bringing up a child on your own, and that child, you want your child to have that perfect family unit. You know your reality doesn't reflect that, but you live, the perpetrator draws you into a reality. But you create, you form a fantasy yourself. So the perpetrator forms a fantasy and draws you in, and then you form another fantasy yourself of, no, they will change. It will be this perfect family unit, but it never ever happens.
No, because obviously, often we're trying to, people are trying to right a wrong because they're trying to create something that they didn't have, maybe. But again, from a family patterns perspective, what I would encourage everybody to do is to look at their parents, look at their parents and look at their dynamic. And maybe that's something that we can go on to talk about in a moment.
Well, we're just going to break for a short interval, and we will be back in a short minute.
The station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise, elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back to the second part of this show. And we're going to follow back on with talking about the importance of looking back on how your parents were, what was their relationship like? What were you exposed to? What sort of behaviors were you exposed to? Were you exposed to disrespect? Was there a lot of name calling in your house? Was there any silent treatment? I know that's something that I was no stranger to throughout my childhood. The silent treatment would go on for quite some time in my house. And I know as an adult, it's something that I don't like being ignored. And that does stem back to my childhood. So in my own domestic abusive relationship, and he would ignore me when I was trying to discuss an issue with him, that would really frustrate me. And it would, that can cause somebody to develop, escalate into a reactive abusive response. Now, although that's not something I ever did, because again, I was conditioned from a very young age that if I do retaliate as a result of somebody else, the perpetrator's, the abuser's behavior, that will lead to consequences and it will be backfired. It will backfire on me and I will be labeled as the problem, even though it's their behavior I'm responding to. So I learned very, very quickly to be very, very mindful of that. But yeah, we've got to look at the generational patterns of how you behave and how that's been formed, and what was your parents like together?
Mm. Yeah, really? absolutely. And if you think about what you've just said about the silent treatment, what we have to remember, if we really simplify this, a human being's sole focus in life is staying alive. That is survival. So a child's focus is survival. So when they are given the silent treatment, that feels like they're being removed, pushed out of their fold, out of their pack. So they're being rejected. And when that happens, if you think about pack animals, if you think about a pack of lions, if one of the cubs is rejected out of the pack, they will die. They will die. Now, although as baby or as children, we won't die, but we can't go and get a mortgage. We can't get a job. You know, as children, we can't do any of that thing. So we're solely reliant on our parents' behavior. So the thing is, what probably happened for you was in adulthood that triggered that old wound, a fear of being rejected, abandoned, all of those things. Now, although you're a perfectly, you know, you're a perfectly capable adult and you could look after yourself, that's not what the wound is saying. The wound is saying, oh my goodness, this is terrible, because it was a repeated. And going back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, children aren't harmed or damaged through one event. These are repeated events. So if you're tired and exhausted and you shout, that child is not going to be damaged, you know, irrevocably as a result of that. We're talking about an environment that is difficult, challenging, and potentially toxic.
Yeah, it's a repeated incident, an occurrence of name calling. Repeated occurrence of silent treatment. It's a repeated occurrence of all those things. Absolutely. And it's all those things building up all together as well. So it's not just that one thing. It's not just, oh God, I'm sick of you.
Yeah.
Or you're stupid. It's not that one thing. It's everything all together. And this is where the complexity of coercive control comes in, because it isn't black and white. It isn't just a case of you've ignored somebody for a day because you're having a really, really bad day. Because actually, sometimes, and this is what I always say to people, if your child is behaving in a way that's triggering you, and you know you're being emotionally triggered, rather than react, you're better off staying silent. Because your wound's exposed, you're reacting, you're likely to react from your own wound. That younger part of you is going to feel attacked. So you, rather than react, which isn't going to get anywhere, because all it's going to do is send a greater sense of danger to that child's nervous system, and they're going to act out even more. So nothing's going to be achieved. So you are better off saying nothing, removing yourself to another room, calming yourself down. Teaching your children how to self-regulate is really, really important, so that they can, when you remove yourselves from to another room, they can turn that dial down on the rage that they're feeling and the injustice that they're feeling, and gain some perspective. You can do exactly the same thing, and then you can come together and you can talk about what the problem was and why they were feeling the way they were and why you their behavior made you feel the way it did. Until you've turned that dial down, there's no point in trying to engage and have a conversation. Because
I agree with you, and I think that can be a really useful thing to do. The danger of removing yourself to another room can be very much what we spoke about a moment ago, of that being perceived by the child as a silent treatment. And it would not be uncommon for the child to be even more enraged that you've dared to remove yourself. So communication has to come in there as well.
This is where you don't do it for a long period of time.
No.
Look, mummy's just going to go to another room. We both need to calm down, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah.
That's the importance, because there's nothing to be gained by trying to reason with somebody that isn't operating from the rational part of their mind. No. If you operate from the emotional part of the brain, logic is not going to come in and rationale is not going to come in. You can't reason with somebody who's operating from that part of the brain.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, when we go into a state of flux from anxiety, stress, anger, remember, anger and anxiety are very closely linked because we've got the fight or flight. But we go into this dysregulated mode. So our front brain, our logical reasoning brain shuts down and our threat system fires up. So we're not thinking. So this is where we come into the react. So then we react by either shouting back or saying something that we'd rather not say, or getting involved in this debate that the child is bringing to the table. But it takes one breath to bring the front brain back online. And that's what I want people to see, is whoever is emotionally dysregulated in your household, even if they've triggered you, it takes one breath to actually go from react to respond. So we literally just need that moment. And that person might still be jabbering about what's going on in their world, but you can take that breath, bring that front brain online so that you can respond in a rational, calm manner. And what we've got to remember is children aren't there to, they're not trying to upset us. They're just trying to get their needs met. And sometimes they're trying to get their needs met in a way that they may be copying, like we've spoken before about, they copy the other parent maybe. If they know that the other parent is manipulating, they've watched how they've been able to manipulate them, and they pick up that information and they run with it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's really important. And going back to what we were talking about earlier about our parents, I would encourage everybody to, as a couple, look at your own individual parents and look at what their relationship style looked like, because you can bet your life it will be playing out in your relationship right now. And you may, you know, for example, if you're in a relationship where your partner is emotionally abusive, physically coercive, control, whatever part of that is, you are likely to see some element of that in your own parents' relationships. One of the things that comes to the table a lot in my work is when people have been raised in an environment where one of their parents is emotionally unavailable. So they're just emotionally, often dad can be.
Actually, it's very, very, very common for, and this is where, so obviously, as we know, children who have been had a traumatic childhood, have a higher risk of getting into trouble with the law, engaging in criminal activity, becoming abusers themselves, having drug addictions or alcohol problems. There's a higher risk of those things occurring. Now, a lot of people will particularly label single mums and single parent households as the problem when those things occur. Now, let's look at the conditions that surround a single mother, particularly if they're a sole parent where there's got no support network in place at all. There are potentially being bombarded with, still being bombarded with abuse from the other parent. Post-separation abuse, stalking incidents will be occurring. Maybe they're engaging with the authorities. Maybe they're being ignored and not being taken seriously. And they're constantly living in survival mode. So as we said, the brain works to keep us safe. That's its number one goal, is to keep us safe. That mother will be so distracted with being in survival and keeping herself and her children alive from what represents danger, and that is the perpetrator and, to some extent, the professionals that should be keeping her safe and her children safe, but they don't, they fail. Because she's so distracted, she's also hypervigilant, you're not emotionally engaged with your child. That's something I can personally relate to. That's something I have to be very, very mindful and aware of myself. Unless you have an awareness of your own emotional state and how you're responding, you can't address it. A lot of the time, single mothers who've escaped domestic abuse will have an emotional detachment with their children, not because they're a bad parent, but because they're operating from survival as a result of the conditions they've been forced to live under. Now, that's not to say that they're not meeting the child's immediate needs. They're keeping them fed, they're keeping them housed, they're keeping them warm, they're keeping them safe, they're giving them love, but they might not be giving them the attention that they want and desire, i.e., Mummy, I want you to sit and have a movie night with me. Now, this is a personal scenario. Now, I'm busy putting together professional training to start rolling out to professionals. I've been supporting some victims with police and family court, which requires me writing reports and things like that. So because I am juggling around school time, her clubs, that limits the time that I have to do the work that I've got to do. So I've got to fit it around my daughter's needs and commitments. So I don't have time sometimes to sit down and watch a movie with her. I don't have time to sit down and play with her dolls. There's that detachment, because I'm thinking, I'm operating from survival in survival. So I know if I don't do X, Y, and Z, then I can't maintain this situation that we have. I can't meet the academic needs that I've committed to, because she can't go into mainstream because it's too distressing for her. She was academically behind by 3 years, so I had no choice but to pull her out of that situation. So I had to sort out a home ed tutoring group scenario, which is basically she's tutored by a privately in a small group with a teacher. It's a normal school environment, but that comes at a cost, and it comes at a cost financially and time, both. Well, I've got to factor that in. So you juggle lots and lots of balls when you are a sole parent, and that can come at a cost. And that cost is that emotional detachment, where they want you to spend time sitting and watching a movie. They want you to sit and play dolls with them, or if it's a boy, sit and play football with them. They want you to do those things with them, but you don't have the physical time to do that. And they can feel like, well, Mommy doesn't love me, I'm not important. That's a story that they're making up in their own subconscious mind.
But again, I think spending time with children is really important. But I think in some ways we've got to sort of run this a little bit deeper, because what we do know is that people that are traumatized could also have a capacity often to dissociate. So this is where they emotionally disconnect from themselves and the world.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I think very often people can be in a room, but they're not in a room. They're there physically, but they're not actually mentally and emotionally there. And sometimes that's the thing we need to be focusing on. Even if we don't have the time, we have the connection.
Yeah, and that's a difficult part for a single mother. It's really, really challenging because they are juggling so many different balls, and just trying to keep their head above water that they can lose sight of that one-to-one connection. Mm. So we're just going to break for another interval and we will carry on with this topic of connection.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back to the final part of this episode. This is such a huge topic, and I think there's definitely going to have to be another episode with Nicola, because it is such a huge topic, unfortunately.
It's huge. Yeah. It's absolutely huge. And I think what's really important for today's episode is really to get people to be thinking about their family cycles, their family patterns, and what's being repeated in their environment now. There's a couple of things I just want you to be thinking about. One of the things I think is really, really powerful is to think about your child, depending on how old they are, in 10, 20, 30 years' time. What do you want for your child? How do you want them to be? You know, what sort of relationship do you want them to be in? You know, what do you want for their career prospects? You know, really start to think about what you want for your child as an adult, because that doesn't just happen. That happens from the day that they're born. So everything that you're modeling in my program, I talk about, imagine there's aliens on other planets, and they're looking at your home, trying to work out how to be a human, how to pass themselves off as a human. And every piece of data that you're giving them, they're like, right, okay, this is what we do. This is what we do to pass ourselves off as this human. This is what we do. This is what our children are doing. I'm not suggesting that people's children are aliens, but what I am suggesting is they are like sponges. They are taking up that data from whether or not Brussels sprouts are nice or not, if you don't like Brussels sprouts, then chances are they won't. I just want to give a little example. This is a really benign example. I've always been terrified of frogs. I have no idea why I'm terrified of frogs, or I didn't have any idea until about 2 years ago. And my mother and I were talking about something. She said, oh God, I hate frogs. They scare the hell out of me. Now, I didn't know that, but I've always had this fear of frogs. Now, I suspect at some point in my preverbal life, so up until the age of two or three, I suspect I witnessed my mother responding to a frog, I would imagine.
Well, I'm exactly the same, Nick. I'm exactly the same. I have gone all my life up until recently disliking anything the colour green. I wouldn't wear anything with clothes that were green. I wouldn't have anything in the house that was green. And that was my dad. My dad hated the colour green.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, whose opinion and thoughts was that? It wasn't mine. It was my dad's that was been influenced upon me.
Mm.
Because actually, I love green. Mm. My wallpaper's green. My decor in my living room is a soft pastely green. Same as 13. I have gone my whole life avoiding anything to do with number 13. Now that's from my dad.
Mm. But again, these are things that are quite have been clear to you. Your dad didn't like green. But I think this is where the subtleties, and this is what I want really people to understand. That, for example, a pre-verbal children, even as an adult, we cannot describe what happened to us pre-verbal because we didn't have a language then. If we had an ice cream pre-verbal, we will only be able to identify even now as something cold. Because we didn't have a language. And I think it's really important to recognise that there's those real subtleties that are coming through our family patterns of our parents uploading their data. And I want really people to be thinking about, what are you uploading to your child? What is it that you're trying to get in that 20, 30, 40 years time? You know, are you removing yourself emotionally from them because you're trying to heal your own wounds or you're trying to look after your own wounds? But what is that likely to be? What's happening to your child as a result of that? What can you do differently so that your child doesn't experience that sense of abandonment and rejection? Now, this isn't about blame and criticism, because no parent is going to get it 100% right all of the time. But when you've been in an abusive relationship, or you've either come out of it or you're still in it, you know, that's a really difficult path to navigate. Yeah. Really difficult.
And this is why in my program of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough bundle, I include regulation tools for the woman that's the mother that's been abused, because it is predominantly women that I focus on. But I've also given them tools to use with their children.
Mm.
So it's, yes, you as the one who's the abuse has been targeted at predominantly, and obviously that there are obviously exceptions to that where the children are also being directly targeted by the perpetrator also. But let's use the example of the most common, where it's the mother that's been targeted, and actually the kids are just a pawn in that very sick game. They need to heal their own wounds to be able to show up how their children need them to show up. But then they also need to teach them the tools to regulate themselves and soothe their own wounds, the wounds that have been developed as a result of what they've just been exposed to.
What's really tricky here is so many adults don't regulate their own emotions because they've not been taught how to regulate. And this is where it begins. As adults, as parents, we have to learn about our own emotional landscape and learn to regulate and manage our emotions before we can even begin to help our children do that.
Exactly. So really, it's a minefield for the poor mother that is trying to navigate all these issues, juggle all these balls. But you have to somehow find a way to heal together so the child feels that connection and doesn't feel, because they will already feel a sense of abandonment from the other parent. What we need is them to feel, have one person that they feel safe with and they feel connected with. And that's another reason why I feel very strongly about, particularly if the children are aware of what's gone on with the other parent, not lying to them, which is something actually the family courts try to encourage. They want you, they try to get parents to sugarcoat the situation, when actually, if that child's been exposed to toxic and abusive environments, and they know the reason why daddy isn't around anymore, or daddy isn't around, or they're not having contact with daddy, or mummy has to go no contact from daddy. They're acutely aware of what's gone on. If you minimize that, actually, you're teaching them again that actually, no, we've got to carry on making excuses for bad behavior. And that is something we can't have our children go through life being taught. That actually, we make excuses for bad behavior, we excuse bad behavior, or we stay silent.
But I think if you think about what you're saying, I think there's a big gap in the middle of that, because I think you're right. I personally think that we should always be as honest as we possibly can be in an age appropriate way. The challenge here is the age appropriate. And what the family courts are probably saying is, we don't want children exposed to excessive detail about things, but that doesn't mean as parents we cannot explain to our children honestly and openly in an age appropriate way. Sometimes they don't need detail. They just, because kids know they're not
So,
stupid.
yeah. So on the topic of the family court, there are sort of, so let's say a child doesn't feel safe with the other parent, but yet family court are saying, actually, no, you need to force them to go and see dad. Regardless of what they're saying, they don't have a choice. They've got to go. You can't minimize their experience. If they don't, if they're verbalizing, they don't feel safe, it's for a reason. We can't, are forcing them to go somewhere that they don't feel safe and saying, oh, but daddy loves you. And, you know, and they actually know that's not true, or they feel that's not true. Minimizing how they feel because of what they've experienced personally as a result of what the other parent has done and how they've behaved and conducted themselves is absolutely not acceptable. And that's what the family courts quite often encourage, which is very dangerous and damaging to the child long term, because it is, it's teaching them actually, no, you've got to submit. You don't feel safe with that person, and for valid reason, but you've got to submit.
But
You've
again,
got to comply.
if you think about it, all of this is about control, whether it be the abuser have control, whether it, but what often it is for the child is they have no power. Now,
No.
children don't have any power anyway, and this is why we need to give them power age appropriately. But if you think about that one situation, so you know that person, that child can't advocate for themselves and say, I don't want to be here, but an adult can advocate for them and say the complete opposite.
And that's the problem. The family courts don't take that on board either.
Yeah.
That parent will be labelled as the problem and accused of parental alienation. So that's the, that's the, that it's such a huge problem. But that's another topic in itself as well. But we are going to have to wrap up, and we will be doing another episode with Nicola, because we've got a lot, there's lots and lots of topics that we can talk about.
So many.
Already. But as a final message, and pearls of wisdom, what would your final pearls of wisdom be for listeners that are struggling?
If you wouldn't want your child to go through what you're going through right now, then why is it okay for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not just about getting yourself safe. It's about doing what's right for your child.
Yeah.
Now, immediately, and in the long term. It's a long-term implications.
You both deserve to live a happy life. That doesn't mean it's going to be exciting and ecstatic all the time, but just to know that you're safe, you're content, and you're warm. And that's all any of us want. That's all any of us strive to have in life. But it's how you navigate that. And you have the power to do that. I am a massive believer, Kate, and I've worked with many, many, many people with many wounds. We have the capacity to heal from all of our wounds. I'm not saying that we end up having scars. Yes, we do, but we don't have any open wounds.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has the capacity if they so choose to.
Yes, they do. Thank you for listening. And we shall see you next week with another guest where we're going to follow on with this topic on the effects of domestic abuse on children.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Kate's work, head to her bio on UK Health Radio. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and always remember, you're not alone.